Well, good afternoon again. You're brave souls, I'll tell you. After a large lunch meal to come out at this time of day all week, and many of you have been here all week, I've truly been blessed by being here. And it's been a busy week, hasn't it? We've had a lot to digest. The messages of this week, I've just been savoring, and I'm actually looking forward to the drive home today. After our meeting concludes, I have some things to attend to before Sabbath draws upon us, and I'm looking forward actually to that quiet time in the car just to digest some of what I've heard this week. I've truly been blessed. What an amazing camp meeting this has been. You know, Friday is for farmers is kind of a special day, at least for this farmer. Not only do we prepare our families for Sabbath, but we prepare our farms for Sabbath too. Sunday is one of my busiest days because I'm coming back to the farm after its period of rest, along with my period of rest, and Monday is a difficult day, and Tuesday I'm preparing for farmer's market, and Wednesday is marketing day, and Thursday we're cleaning up after marketing day and taking care of needs on the farm, and then Friday I can usually get up and just actually enjoy the garden a little bit. Not that there aren't problems there, but I have time to think and consider and ponder and really appreciate what the Lord has done for us that particular week as we head into the Sabbath. And it's one of my favorite times of the week is on Friday. And we've kind of followed that schedule this week a little bit. I first spoke to you on Sunday, a work day, and that was a busy day, wasn't it? We worked hard on that day to digest some of what I shared with you. And then on Wednesday, which is the biggest day of my week, we had a big day too with all that talk about cation exchange capacity and so forth. Yeah, you be careful. Why don't you find a seat over there, okay? So today I want to kind of follow that pattern a little bit, and I just want to have a little bit of a relaxed environment here today. And I told you yesterday that I would be setting some time aside for your questions because, as I said, I will be leaving shortly after my presentation. I've had a chance to talk with a lot of you informally, but I won't be able to present that opportunity to you today. So if you have questions that have been troubling you, please hold them for the end here. I wanted to share a little bit with you today about greenhouses, because that's a question that has consistently come up. And I've got some things to show you today that I think will be very encouraging to you and very instructive to you too. I want to read something though before we start, since this is Friday and it is my day for spiritual reflection as I work on the farm, earnest spiritual reflection as I work on the farm. I want to read something to you from Bible Commentaries, First Bible Commentaries, page 1112. The tithing system was instituted by the Lord as the very best arrangement to help the people in carrying out the principles of the law. If this law were obeyed, the people would be entrusted with the entire vineyard, the whole earth. Men were to cooperate with God in restoring the diseased land to health, that it might be a praise and a glory to His name. And as the land they possessed would, if managed with skill and earnestness, produce its treasures, so their hearts, if controlled by God, would reflect His character. In the laws which God gave for the cultivation of the soil, He was giving the people opportunity to overcome their selfishness and become heavenly minded. Canaan would be to them as Eden if they obeyed the word of the Lord. Through them, the Lord designed to teach all the nations of the world how to cultivate the soil so that it would yield healthy fruit free from disease. The earth is the Lord's vineyard and is to be treated according to His plan. Those who cultivated the soil were to realize that they were doing God's service. They were as truly in their lot and place as were the men appointed to minister in the priesthood and in work connected with the tabernacle. Brothers and sisters, over time, Satan has done his best to denigrate the activity of gardening and agriculture. And you know as well as I do that for a son for a father to desire that his son go into gardening or go into agriculture, at least in the last century or so, was really something very rare. Most fathers, even if they were engaged in agriculture, wanted their young children to think more in professional terms, to look to the medical work or to become successful in some other line of vocation. But as we can see here, one of the most noble professions that we can take up, particularly in this time of Earth's history, is to understand more about the soil, to contemplate the Lord in the environment that He created, not that we created, and to use what we learn to reach the hearts of others and bring people to the kingdom. That's my desire. I want to share with you a little bit today about why we're in West Virginia. This question has come to me a number of times this week, and I thought it would be appropriate to share with you a little bit about God's providence and how we have come to be residents of this wonderful state, and I truly am thrilled to be able to call myself a West Virginian. The journey started a few years ago. I was called into the ministry about 10 years ago and realized initially that my skills in agriculture were really kind of maybe an awkward fit for someone that wanted to serve the Lord, and then I realized that I'm not called to preaching and I'm not called to evangelism as we traditionally understand it, but I wanted to serve the Lord, and I found an opportunity at a small college to teach an agriculture course to missionary students, and I thought, well, this is a way that I can accomplish that. And I was very, very fulfilled in doing that. I enjoyed working with the young people tremendously. But on the other hand, I was somewhat troubled for people that I met that had young children, older couples, established families, that also wanted to learn about agriculture but didn't really have any venue or opportunity to do that. I have some close friends in ministry. Jerry Franklin is one, and so is Dave Westbrook, and the Meisners are good friends of mine, all of which have ministries that are basically calling people to a simpler life of purity and simplicity away from urban environments. And people were responding to their calls, but they didn't have any place to take the first step to really understand what that meant. What was country living really all about? None of them had opportunities to really see a functioning type of endeavor in the country where they could leave not only their former lifestyles behind, but in most cases, their employment and their financial security too. So about 5 years ago, my wife and I were praying together, and we really felt the Lord leading us to step away from the college environment and to establish a small farm of our own where we could build essentially a demonstration farm to show others that yes, this can be done. Yes, the Lord will provide for us if we follow His plan, and that it is possible to derive a living from agriculture in a rural environment. We also have a daughter at home still that's 12 years old. We have 5 grown children, but our 12-year-old daughter we were concerned for too. And many of us that are raising children in these times realize the challenges of keeping those children in an environment where the Holy Spirit can influence them without all of the tremendous distractions that children are exposed to these days. So we started looking for land, and we started our search primarily on the internet. I was originally from the West Coast. My wife was originally from Massachusetts by way of Tennessee, and she had traveled extensively on the West Coast as a contract nurse for many years before we met. So we knew quite a bit about the country, and we knew what kind of characteristics and qualities we were looking for. And we also realized that after working for 10 years in ministry on a small stipend, we didn't have a lot of resource to work with, so we had to consider economics too. And for a variety of different reasons, our focus kept coming back to West Virginia. One of the reasons that I really appreciate being here is that in West Virginia, we have a degree of isolation from many of those problems, not only in society, but also in agriculture that we've talked about this week. I wanted to be in a place where I didn't have to worry about pollen drift from genetically modified crops. I heard from Sister Goss this morning. She was alerting me to a new vegan cookbook that she thought my wife might be interested in that was produced by a young lady that lives up in Illinois, where she lives with her husband, who does pretty much what I'm doing. They have a small market farm, and they sell their produce at the local farmer's market, but they're surrounded by GMO crops. And one of the growers was out spraying those GMO crops about 2 weeks ago with Roundup on a day when he shouldn't have been spraying. The wind was blowing excessively. It blew that Roundup into their fields and basically devastated their production for this year. And I'd like you to pray for those folks. I don't know them personally, but please keep them in your prayers. Those are the types of things that I wanted to avoid. I'm also a country boy, even though I came from California. I came from Northern California, in the mountains of Northern California, nonetheless. And I worked in the valleys where the agriculture took place, but I actually built a home and raised my my older kids in the mountains. And I love the environment here. I love the beauty of nature. And to find the beauty of nature interspersed with lands that were suitable for cultivation was our objective. And that's what we found in this little farm in Menorah. This is a map of the farm that we finally purchased. The Lord led us to this in a variety of different ways. But what I want you to notice is that, you know, like most of the land in West Virginia, it's got lots of ups and downs, but it's got plenty of downs. And the downs is this large field here, this area here, and then this field right back here is my main vegetable production growing area right now. And we saw a couple of other attributes to this particular property that we found attractive too. There was an old house on the property here. There were hookups for a mobile home here. And then there was another mobile home set up over here. So not only did we have the capacity to provide housing for ourselves, but we had a situation when we could have other folks come and stay with us for a period of time for training too, and that was very attractive to us. The other thing that attracted us, although it is undeveloped, is this little area right back here, which is at the end of a hollow, which we eventually intended as our home site, where we would have the seclusion and the privacy that we sought too. We made an offer on this piece of property in November. And just within about 3 weeks after we made the offer on the property, I got a piece of information through an internet newspaper that's produced in Calhoun County that this property right adjacent to it was coming up for auction. That's the old Menorah School building there. And the previous fall, the county had auctioned that building, and it had been purchased by a pipeline company. But for whatever reasons they may have had, the pipeline company decided that the auction wasn't conducted properly. They basically wanted out of the deal, and they told the county the auction wasn't conducted properly, so they thought they should auction it again. And their minimum bid on that property was $50,000. So when we heard that, you know, when we were first looking at this farm, we noticed this big old building over here, but we really didn't pay much attention to it. That wasn't really on our radar screen. But when we heard this announcement, we thought, well, you know, maybe we should go look at that. That might be something that could be used in the Lord's work. We don't have a dime left in our pockets because we just bought a farm, but we'll see what this is all about and maybe see what opportunities might present themselves. As a consequence of that visit, we went over and looked at this building. It was a large two-story brick concrete block school building that served about 200 students in its prime that had been abandoned in 1998 when they had a consolidation of the school districts and students were moved up to Arnoldsburg about 8 miles away. The building was literally that. It had been used for a few different purposes for community activities, but by and large, it hadn't had any serious maintenance or concern since 1998, so it was in pretty rough shape. But as I looked at it, I realized that the Lord had given me preparation for just such an opportunity. I know enough about plumbing and electrical issues and construction and all those other skills that would be necessary to do the maintenance and the repairs on this building. And one of the things that really caught my attention, you can see these little boxes on the side of the building here, those are all individual room heaters. The building itself is plumbed entirely with natural gas, but there's gas plumbed to each room, and there's no central heating system. This meant that we didn't have to heat the whole building when we weren't going to use the entire building, and that was just astonishing to me. So after looking this over, we were driving home, and we thought, well, what do we do now? You know, this is definitely a facility that could be used in the Lord's work. If it were to be something that we were going to build today, it would probably cost on the order of between $1.75 and $2 million for something like this. We don't really need something this big, but, you know, maybe we should make an effort to try to get it. So I went to a few of my friends. I explained the opportunity that was there to them, and they helped us raise some money. And the short version of the story is that we were motivated to go ahead and commit to purchasing the building. So we submitted a bid to the county that had to be met in 30 days. I had 30 days to come up with the money once we submitted the bid. And the backstory to this is that we were still waiting for the farm property to close when I needed to write the check to pay for this building. I didn't know on the day that I wrote the check to pay for this building whether or not we were going to be able to own the farm that surrounds it or not. But I prayed about it. The Lord led me to a couple of scriptures that impressed my heart to go ahead and take a step in faith and acquire this building. And when I did, I was actually feeling an experience of absolute release and reliance on Him. And it was a wonderful feeling. Within 24 hours, I got a call from the attorney telling me that the farm property closed. So we ended up with both properties, and right now we're conducting our ministry out of this building. We're actually living in the bottom floor of this building, and a portion of the bottom floor of this building. We use this as the housing for the people that come through our training programs. There are 22 classrooms in this building that are about 25 feet by 35 feet in size. It's a massive building. And this isn't all there is to it, because there's also a gymnasium. This is looking at the building from the other end, and this large building right here is a gymnasium that also had a commercial kitchen. They fed 200 children there, so they needed the facility to do that. And I thought, wow, that's really great. You know, if we bought just the farm, I was planning to put up a metal building for a barn anyway, and I can use the gym for my barn. So this is wonderful. And it's been a real blessing. It's been quite a different path than what we thought the Lord was going to put us on when we first came to West Virginia. But our first year here, we arrived just 2 years ago. 2 years ago this month, actually, we started building those greenhouses that you see on the backside of the building there, and I want to talk a little bit about those. But that, kind of in a nutshell, is the story of how we got to be where we are and to do what we do. This is a picture of the backside of the building and some of the greenhouses going up. This picture was taken just a couple of years ago. I hadn't really intended to get into this presentation with you this week, and I didn't bring photographs that I would have liked to have brought with me. Some of these are a little bit old, but it actually may serve a better purpose because so many of you have asked me about cold frames and greenhouses. And I want you to notice, first of all, that the area where these greenhouses is going up is right behind the school building. This is where the playground used to be. And what I did prior to constructing the greenhouses was to take all those steps that we talked about on Wednesday in preparing the soil. The area where we erected the greenhouses, we actually prepared the soil before we built the greenhouses. And I strongly suggest that you consider doing this too if you're thinking of a greenhouse. And the reality is that I think all of you should consider a greenhouse. I'm going to show you the economics of a greenhouse here pretty soon, and it's pretty much a no-brainer as to whether we in this latitude and in this climate that we live in make use of a greenhouse or not. So the soil is prepared. The greenhouses that I use come from a company called Atlas Greenhouse Systems in Georgia. There's a link to their webpage or their website on my website. I found them to be the least expensive and the most efficient greenhouse on the market. And again, I'll go over costs with you here shortly. But a lot of folks have questioned whether or not it's worthwhile to buy a kit, or whether you'd be better off using materials like rebar, or bending the tubing yourselves, or using PVC pipe. A number of different types of greenhouse models are out there, and if you pick up do-it-yourself magazines, they make recommendations about doing those kinds of things. My experience is don't. My experience is that you are far better off buying a pre-manufactured kit for your greenhouse for a couple of reasons. One is that they're not that much more expensive than coming up with the parts and crafting these things yourself. Number two is that since they are a kit, they're formed very close tolerances that allow you to stretch your plastic in a way that will allow your plastic to last much longer than it would on a home-built greenhouse. One of the most destructive forces on plastic, apart from ultraviolet light, is abrasion. And where your plastic goes over these greenhouse frames, if there's any movement at all, the life of your plastic will be shortened tremendously. Now, these greenhouses that I've put up here are 16 feet wide and 54 feet long. And there's a reason for that. I have five of them, and I could have put up one large greenhouse that would have that much square footage. But I preferred to use the smaller greenhouses in this climate for two important reasons. One is snow load. When we get a heavy, wet snow here, as we did about 2 years ago, that snow we had in December 2 years ago was a good example. We had about, I don't recall exactly how much we accumulated, I think we ended up accumulating about 18 inches of a wet, heavy snow. And that much weight on a structure like this will bring it down. But the advantage to the narrow width of this greenhouse is that the center height is only a little over 8 feet. And I can reach to the top of that greenhouse with a push broom and pull the snow off of it, which I had to do a couple of times during that particular storm. So it's easier to build a lighter weight greenhouse that you can manage by pulling snow off of than having to worry about either heating the greenhouse to keep the snow melted off of it or to use some other method to get the snow load off the greenhouse. My bows, the metal parts of the greenhouse here, are 6 feet apart. You'll notice rainbows in some of these pictures. Did anybody notice the rainbow we had last evening? Wasn't that beautiful? But the bows that I have in my greenhouse units here are 6 feet apart. And when I bought the kit from the company down there, they asked me, well, where are you living? I said, West Virginia. He says, oh, no, you can't do that. And I said, oh, yes, I can. They want to sell you kits where the bow spacing is about 4 feet so that the greenhouse structure is stronger and will withstand more of a snow load. But I knew what I was dealing with, and I knew that during periods of heavy snowfall, I will have to go out and pull that snow off. Now, a light snow is not going to be a problem. A typical snow for our part of West Virginia, anyway, is not going to be a problem. These things will stand up to about a foot of light, fluffy, dry snow. The wet, heavy snows are the ones that we need to worry about. The other reason for this length is that in order to preserve the plastic for the greatest life on the greenhouse, you don't want to move it. Once it's in place, if it stays in place, it'll last for 6 or 7 years. If you have what is common for greenhouses of this size, which is roll-up sides on the greenhouse, you're constantly moving that plastic, and the plastic wears out pretty quickly, and you'll need to replace it about every 2 years. And plastic is getting to be quite expensive. So my preference is to leave the plastic on the main part of the greenhouse and just open the end walls. And with a length of 54 feet or less, I get a sufficient breeze coming through that greenhouse to keep the temperatures in the summer from being so high that I can't grow things in there. Now, it's still warmer in the greenhouse than it is outside in the summer, but it's not so much warmer that I can't grow hot weather crops. This time of year, I grow a lot of I grow some of the tomatoes inside, and I grow some of the bell peppers and the other peppers that I grow inside the greenhouses. Things that can take a warmer environment do just fine without any kind of mechanical ventilation or without roll-up sides. I want to keep my greenhouse systems as simple as possible because, in part, our farm I consider to be a demonstration farm. We want to show people ways of doing things that they can duplicate and have success with, too. This is, again, still the first summer that we were there. And once I put these structures up, I planted them immediately. It was in the summer, so we decided to go ahead and make use of the soil that was in there. That's my daughter and one of her friends there picking some green beans. But here you can see a little bit about how the structure goes together. These are basically attached to some 30-inch pipes that are driven into the ground, and it's held together with some pipe straps, and then we lay this baseboard along the edge here to attach the plastic to. On the ends, we have these gussets that keep them from swaying. And folks often want to know how much wind a greenhouse like this will sustain. I've used these for a number of years in a number of different areas, and I have experienced up to sustained winds of 80 miles an hour with these greenhouses and have not had any problems. Now, I mention that because some of you that are avid gardeners might be aware of some of the work that's being done by Elliot Coleman. Elliot Coleman is a grower up in New England who's produced a number of books about growing crops all year round using high tunnels or greenhouses like this. Only he has a little bit of a different system. He advocates putting these on a movable system where you can move the greenhouse from time to time so you can expose the soil to the elements and freshen crops. You can grow crops outdoors until the weather starts to change and then pull a greenhouse over your crops. And he claims there are some advantages to doing that. I disagree with that because I think that the potential for wind damage is very, very high. And indeed, a friend of mine, Larry Lesher, who is operating the agriculture program up at Black Hills Health and Education Institute, is experiencing that just now. He built a couple of those movable greenhouses that are about the size of these that I have, and they had a windstorm about 3 weeks ago that basically picked one of these up, carried it about a half a mile, and twisted it, tangled it, and destroyed it in the process. So I don't advocate the use of those movable greenhouse systems. Now, the concept of using these greenhouses, technically these are cold frames. I call them greenhouses because that's what everybody else around here likes to call them, but these are really actually just cold frames. And by cold frame, what I mean is that we don't have any mechanical systems inside of them. We have no heating systems inside of them except for one. And they're a very simple structure that's intended to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to provide a warmer environment for crops that are growing during the cold part of the year. That's their primary function. They also serve well in the summertime in a humid environment like we have to keep moisture off of your crops, and that can be very helpful if you're growing things like small berries or tomatoes. How many of you grow tomatoes and have a lot of trouble with cracked skins in the summer on your tomatoes? Well, one of the ways to avoid that is to keep any moisture off of your tomatoes, and if you're growing old heirloom varieties or open pollinated varieties, many of those are very susceptible to cracking, and if you're marketing them, that makes things very difficult. So we grow some of those under plastic during the summer, not because they need the additional heat, but because the plastic protects them from that humid environment. And now you can see these are small greenhouses, but there's quite a bit of produce growing in here. And here's the economics of it. I want you to pay attention to this. The steel, the fasteners, all of the special hardware, and the freight for the greenhouse kit from Alabama or from Georgia cost me $575. Now, this is an 864 square foot greenhouse. This is 16 feet by 54 feet. The plastic cost $140, and that's a good quality 6 mil greenhouse grade plastic. Don't try to scrimp on plastic and use something that you buy at Lowe's or Home Depot or something like that that is not intended as a greenhouse plastic, because greenhouse plastic has ultraviolet inhibitors in it that are absolutely necessary for the life of the plastic. If you try to use just a regular standard clear plastic that you would buy at a home store, center, you'll be lucky to get 6 or 8 months of life out of that, whereas this will last, as I said, for 6 or 7 years. It's rated for 4 years, and that rating is based on the plastic's resistance to ultraviolet light. In the western states, we have much higher UV levels than you do here in this part of the country because the air is drier and the UV penetrates the atmosphere better. And also in areas like Colorado, where they are at very high altitude, the ultraviolet is much brighter. So they average the how long this plastic is going to last based on considerations like that. But the reality is even a four-year film will last for 6 or 7 years here. The lumber that's in the greenhouse, including the end walls and the base rails that the plastic is attached to, you buy locally. It cost me $178 for the lumber that's in each of those units. And the door itself, I just bought a cheap wooden screen door at Lowe's for $20. So the total cost for my greenhouse was $913 for 864 square feet. That comes out to $1.06 per square foot. Now, if you build a larger greenhouse or a smaller greenhouse, it's not going to vary tremendously from that dollar a square foot figure. So you can figure about $1 a square foot. Now, the first crop the first production I put through that greenhouse can literally give me a profit over the cost of that greenhouse. I planted lettuce as one of my first crops in that greenhouse, and based on the square footage in the greenhouse, I can get 650 heads of lettuce planted in one of those greenhouses. And if I wholesale that at $1.50 a head, I've made more money than what the greenhouse cost with the very first crop. Lettuce is a short crop. You can grow it. I started in trays, and I transplant it into the ground. I don't plant it from seed. I transplant it into the ground. But it's only in the ground for about 45 days before it's ready to harvest. So 45 days from the time you put up your greenhouse, you paid for it. Now, a lot of folks say, well, you know, that's all well and good, but that's still a lot of money, and we don't sell lettuce at the farmer's market. So, you know, it's still going to be an expense out of our pocket. But you've got to consider the value of the produce, whether or not you're selling it, because if you're not growing it and raising it, that means that you're buying it, so you're paying for that food one way or another. So it has value. Everything that you produce has value. One of those units, 16 feet by 54 feet, will provide a tremendous amount of produce. As I said, the lettuce is only in there for about 45 days before we harvest it. And guess what? As soon as I harvest it, I plant something else in there. And the reality is that over the course of the year, I can get between 4 and 6 crop cycles easily out of each of these greenhouses. In some instances, up to 7 different crop cycles out of that greenhouse. So if you take this income level of $975 and multiply that times between 4 and 7, you get an idea of the productivity of what these greenhouses are. Very, very valuable to have. And especially in an environment like ours, it can dramatically extend your growing season. In fact, our growing season is extended to the point where we literally grow crops year-round in those unheated greenhouses. I'm going to show you some pictures in a moment of what was in there in January of this year. This is the one greenhouse that I do heat. And the reason that I heat it is because I have my propagation benches in here. This is my propagation bench, and I'll show you what I use to get my plants started with in a moment. In this greenhouse now, I actually have a water heater that I use as my heat source, and I've got copper tubing wound back and forth under this bench here so that heat radiates up through that bench during really cold weather, and I keep my seedlings warm. If I didn't do that, these trays could freeze overnight, and the plants, although the stuff that I grow during the cold part of the year can tolerate freezing, the root systems can't. If they're not planted in the ground, you've got to provide some source of heat. So I do add a little bit of heat to this greenhouse, but it's usually nothing more than to keep the greenhouse above freezing. I rarely heat the greenhouse above 34 degrees in the winter. It's simply to keep it above freezing. A lot of folks think that when they look at a greenhouse, wow, that's terrific. You know, I can grow tomatoes all year long. And I don't recommend doing that. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 tells me that to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heavens, and I believe we need to apply that principle to our gardens and not get too extravagant with the concept of growing things that are not well adapted to our area. I prefer to grow things in the winter months that can sustain freezing temperatures so that I don't have to provide heat and can function much more economically, and also I know that there's going to be coming a time when I probably won't be able to afford that heat, and I may not be able to buy it or sell it anyway. These are the plug trays that I use. These are 10 inches wide and 20 inches long. Each of these holds 288 plants, and this is where I start things like lettuce and broccoli and cauliflower. I'll start them all out in these plug trays, and that gives me a tremendous advantage because in a very small space I can grow enough plants to plant my entire farm quite easily. And I also only need to heat, this is all I'm trying to keep warm, are these plug trays. And that is a tremendous advantage in terms of energy too. I use a regular soil mix in those plug trays and I plant the seeds into those. It's also an excellent way to conserve seed, because most of us, when we seed our gardens, we're out there dribbling seed, and we plant vastly more seed than whatever is harvested. And this way, I am able to dramatically conserve seed, which in the other role, the other hat that we wear is that we're a seed bank. We want to preserve some of the old varieties, and in many cases, there are very few seeds available to us. This helps us to make maximum use of what seed we do have. When the plants are grown, I don't have very many good pictures here to share with you about the stage of growth where I transfer them, but when they've sprouted in those plug trays and they're well developed and they have a good root system in that plug tray, I'll pop them out in some cases and transplant them into six packs, just like you see at Walmart or the nurseries or anywhere else, and I'll grow them on in my greenhouse for a period of anywhere from 2 weeks to maybe 4 weeks in the greenhouse before I transplant them into the beds, either outdoors or in the other cold frames. Now this buys me a lot of efficiency because, as I said, when I harvest the crop of lettuce that's currently in the ground, I've got another plant that's already 4 to 6 weeks old that I'm putting back in its place, and it dramatically increases the number of crop cycles that I can get through the year. And that is income or production. This is the garden area between the greenhouses, and this is where our demonstration garden for our classes currently is. And some of you have asked me about fencing. I haven't put the fence up here completely yet, but you can see kind of the method that I used. I took some standard T-posts, and then I found the cheapest material I could find, which was half-inch electrical conduit. And I cut 5-foot strips of that and just welded it to the top of each of these T-posts so that the fence overall is about 8 feet tall. Currently, I have some wire mesh on the lower part of this fence. Out in the larger field that we have a large field too that's about 2 acres. I have simply run electric fence wire down low, about 4 strands, and back and forth up to a height of about 7.5 or 8 feet. And I stagger my hot wires with a ground wire so that if a deer or an animal like a rabbit tries to leap through the fence, if he's not grounded, he wouldn't get shocked. This way he's going to hit 2 wires and get zapped whether he's on the ground or not. And that has worked very effectively for us. Most of you have asked me, what do you do about deer? There's no easy answer to that. It is an investment to put the fence up, but on the other hand, when you consider the potential for production on an acre of land, it's a very, very good investment to make. You know, most of the average corn and soy farmers in the country are generating no more than maybe $200 per acre income. And on an intensively farmed, organic market farm today, you can expect to generate between $20,000 and $30,000 a year worth of income. It's a significant amount of money. And if you're going to have that much potential out there, you'd put a fence around it, wouldn't you? Okay, so I think that for those of you that are questioning whether or not it's worth the expense or not, it definitely is worth the expense. I don't like the looks of a fence. I wish we didn't have to use them. They do have a cost, an aesthetic cost, if you will, but they are certainly necessary in these times. These are the greenhouses with the plastic stretched over them. If you tap on that plastic, you're going to hear the sound like you're banging on a timpani. It's stretched tight. And that's one of the advantages to having a greenhouse kit, is you can get the plastic stretched to the point where it will not move or chafe against those boughs, and will not flutter in the wind. And we just recently had some very tremendous winds in our area. My greenhouses are standing and doing just fine, and I expect that plastic to last me for at least 4 or 5 more years. So that's really the best advice I can give you. For those of you that are thinking about doing this yourself, I think you'd be hard-pressed to build a greenhouse for $1 a square foot, even if you were trying to make it out of local or other discarded materials. This is our classroom. This is our first class. You may recognize a couple of faces in this picture. This was from a little over a year ago. This was our first training session at Berea Gardens. And a lot of what our training program involves is what we were covering the other day. We cover some very important aspects of soil chemistry and balancing the soil. I try to make it simple enough so that you can digest the information, and we have a lot more time to do it there than we did here in 1 hour on one afternoon. But we have had quite a number of people come through the program to this point. This was our very first graduating class from Berea Gardens. And this is the area. This is last year's garden. This year's garden looks very much like this right now. It was taken about the same time of year. The rows, I've practiced crop rotation, so the rows are laid out differently. But this was taken probably the first part of June last year. And this, again, is our demonstration garden. Now, folks have asked me about raised beds. If you look closely at these, I don't know if you can see it well in these pictures or not, but these beds are basically permanent beds that I've established. I don't have any edges on the side of them, but they are slightly raised, and I have walkways between these beds that are dedicated walkways. One of the rules that I have is that we never walk in the beds. Once those beds are formed and made, we will not walk through them. And these were made nearly a year and a half ago, and I venture to say that there's been nary a footprint in those beds since they were made. As these crops have come out, I've applied compost and other things to them for this year's growing season, but we maintain the beds as permanent beds, and that allows us to build organic matter. It allows us to build earthworm populations, and has lots of other advantages for developing the biology of the soil. The other aspect of having them raised slightly is that it also provides us with very good drainage. Now, our soil is a pretty coarse soil. It drains very well, but even so, the lower end of this cucumber bed right here, when we get heavy rains and we have all the water coming off of that school building, it can tend to flood from time to time. So having a little elevation on that bed has helped us from having any problems there either. This is another class that we had. I wanted to point out that not only have we had folks from the church come through our program, but we've had a number of our neighbors and local residents come through the program too, people that are not members of our church. They've been blessed with the opportunity to understand agriculture from the perspective of the Spirit of Prophecy. I use quite a bit of the Spirit of Prophecy and the counsel that was given to us and the instruction that I give in the courses, and I don't change it when we have people that haven't been members of our church or exposed to these things before, and by and large, they're richly blessed by what they've learned. One of the greatest evangelistic fields that we have, I believe, are people in this area that originally came to West Virginia as part of the Back to the Land movement back in the 60s and 70s. These folks all have a longing for understanding truth. They have a degree of confusion in their hearts because they haven't found where that truth is, and they have a resistance or a reluctance to accept it from something as traditional as the Bible. But the reality is that the Bible truths that we have to share with them are exactly what they're looking for, and we have so much commonality. When they start hearing counsel that we had 100 years ago that pertains to agriculture that strikes home in their hearts, then they begin to open up and have a greater appreciation for those other Bible truths that we may choose to share with them too. So I call that my evangelistic program, using vegetables for evangelism. This is a crop in one of the cold frames just to help emphasize how productive that area is. You can see things are packed in there pretty tight. Again, inside the greenhouse as well as outside, we maintain dedicated walkways. This is some broccoli here, some red cabbage, looks like some Hansen leaf lettuce over here, and this is cauliflower that's growing in there. And again, when you start counting plants and counting the population that we have, the density that's in there, you can realize the productivity is just enormous. You multiply that times 5 and you get the idea of what you can do in the course of a year there. This is a photograph from last year of the field that we currently have planted. This is about a 2-acre field, and you'll see my cover crop of red clover back here. This field is all now fenced and currently in production. We have cauliflower and beets and spinach. What else do we have out there? 3 different varieties of green beans. I've got some sweet corn out there, melons, cucumbers, potatoes, and tomatoes in that field right now. Another picture of the red clover. Isn't that beautiful? We had neighbors driving by that kept stopping by and asking us, what did you plant out there? Our gymnasium also has been very useful to us. This is a picture inside the gym. We had Brother Jerry Franklin come and do some meetings at our place a year ago October. It was actually before he came to camp meeting here last year. And this, again, is just demonstrating the providence of God to provide us with a facility where we could do something like that. But in that I bid $51,000 when we bought the building. Not only did we get the building, but we got all the stuff that was left inside the building, including all of these chairs. Back in this corner is the commercial kitchen that served the student body that was there. There's a 10-burner gas range in there, a convection oven, a dishwasher, all the sinks, commercial refrigeration. Everything that we could possibly need is there, and more. And we are still pondering what the Lord may have in mind for the full utility of this building. We certainly are blessed and we're making good use of it, but we know that there's potential for much more to occur here too. Last year, right after Thanksgiving, we had an agriculture conference at Berea Gardens. I believe it's the first agriculture conference that's been held in the history of our denomination. And part of the impetus for this was a man named Bob Jorgensen, who lives down in North Carolina, who has been an historian and a student of Adventist education. And he has traveled to places like Avondale and Andrews University, looking into the history of Emmanuel Missionary College, as well as Madison, and has some very interesting insights on agriculture and its relationship to practical training in Adventist education. So we held a week-long seminar last year. We did the first weekend seminars on true education, including practical training. We did a week-long agriculture training session where not only I taught, but others who are engaged in active ministry in agriculture in Seventh-day Adventism, including the Deisinger family from Tennessee, and some others, and along with that came another friend of mine, Dave Westbrook, who spoke to us on some issues too pertaining to his Out of the Cities call and how important agriculture is to that. So the facility has truly been a blessing to us. Told you I'd show you some winter pictures. This is the greenhouse. It's got some broccoli and some lettuce transplants in there and some cauliflower. This picture was taken, I believe, on either the 10th or the 17th of January of this year. It was about, I think, 15 or 20 degrees outside when we took this picture. We, previous to this, had temperatures down as low as 0, and we still have production in there. This is another one of the greenhouses. These are beets, and it's hard to discern in this, but if you went in there and you grabbed those leaves at the time this was taken early in the morning, those leaves are literally brittle from being frozen. But as the day warms up, those leaves will thaw out and they will continue to grow. Your growth rate during the winter is very much slower, obviously, because you have shorter day length and the plants have to thaw out before they can start to grow again. But things can happen. We were able to harvest beets all winter long. This is spinach over here. We have carrots in the ground over here. Those are some turnips in the back there. We basically harvested out of our garden all year long this year. And I'm still new to this area, so I'm still kind of pushing the edges to see what can be done. So I even grew crops outdoors this year. And I didn't know what to expect. I wanted to see what we can get away with. I didn't provide any protection for these crops. I simply wanted to plant them out there and see what would happen. We have some beds of cabbage and kale out here. And again, this was taken early in the morning, so things are frozen solid, but we were able to harvest produce out of that garden up until about the end of January or the first part of February. And because of that, when our local farmers market stopped its season at the end of October, we moved the farmers market to our place on Wednesday mornings and opened our place from 9 to 1 on Wednesdays and had people coming all winter long. And the witness that we were able to provide to those people was tremendous. Again, evangelism, I guess is the word. We used vegetables for our evangelism. I want to show you a little bit of the difference here between growing things inside a cold frame in marginal weather and growing them outdoors. This is a crop of red Russian kale. This is curled Siberian kale in this bed. This is red Russian kale. This photograph was taken about the first week of April. And that kale was planted about 6 to 7 weeks ahead of that. So from transplants. Now remember, I start things in transplants, and this is about between 6 and 8 weeks later, maybe. At the same time I planted this kale, I planted this kale. These pictures were taken on the same day. Same kale, transplanted at the same time. The stuff I transplanted outside hasn't grown hardly at all. The stuff that I planted inside is ready for harvest, and indeed was ready for harvest sometime before this photograph was taken. So it gives you a concept of the value of growing things in a controlled environment, even though these are not heated. Even though they're not heated, they're tremendously valuable. We did a seminar in conjunction with the West Virginia University Extension Service on these cold frames a year ago January, because the Natural Resources Conservation Service was actually conducting a program where they were giving grants to people to build these things. And that grant program, I believe, is still in place in a number of counties in West Virginia. So if you have a desire to put one of these up, we chose to do ours on our own and not involve ourselves with a government grant program. But when you get home, if you're interested in building one of these, talk to your local county farm advisor's office, because it's very possible that you may qualify for some grant funding to help you build one of these things, too. Beg your pardon? Occasionally I will. It depends on the crops that are in there. We've not been there long enough for me to really build a lot of organic matter in the soil yet. So I do, the soil will compact with irrigation over time. Even rainfall will compact soil, but the more organic matter that I build in there over time, the less frequently I will till in there. And usually when I say till, I'm doing it mostly by hand. Occasionally, if I get a bed that's really compacted, I'll run my rototiller over it, but for the most part, I do it just with a potato fork. And I turn, you know, just grab the soil and loosen it with a potato fork and then replant into it. Oftentimes, the same day that I harvest out of a bed, I will prepare it and replant that same bed the same day. Okay, this is the garden and the demonstration garden in full production. This was taken, I believe, last July, probably early part of July, judging from the sunflowers there. And this year it's very much like that. We have, again, as I said, rotated our crops, so we have things in a different position. But the productivity of this type of garden is absolutely phenomenal. I told you about my bed of cucumbers in the back here. These beds are 5 feet wide, about 45 feet long. 1,100 pounds of cucumbers came out of that bed. When I pulled the cucumber plants out, we planted broccoli in that bed, and we harvested 268 pounds of broccoli out of that bed in one growing season. So when you look at the economics of doing these things, really the biggest challenge for us is finding markets for all that we grow, because we're in a rural area and it's hard to find customers for all of this. But the productivity itself and the capacity for the soil to provide our needs and to provide food for us is excellent. We cannot deny that the Lord is very gracious in how He grows these crops for us. Again, I want to mention that I don't grow these crops, the Lord does. I do my best to try to cooperate with Him. I believe that it's our responsibility if we want to provide for our security to learn how to cooperate with the Lord in that regard. There are some things that are required of us in terms of care for these plants. But when folks look at this kind of a photograph and they say, Bob, you do a beautiful job of growing things, I have to tell them I'm not the one that grows it. I do not know how green beans grow. I don't know how they do that. It's amazing to me that we can put a seed in the ground and that seed turns into something that we can eat in such a short period of time that tastes good and nourishes our bodies. How that happens, I don't know. I do know how to care for the plants in a way that makes my effort efficient and gives me a great return for what the Lord grows, but He's the one that deserves all of the glory and all of the credit for this. What's sad to me is that we, over time, have lost the wisdom of how to do this. And for each generation that goes by, all it takes is one break in that chain of father teaching son to destroy the education of many, many generations. And that's what's happening today, not only here in the United States, but around the world, as people are abandoning the activity of agriculture in favor of this world model of a global-scaled agribusiness industry. And the only way that we're going to find any security for a consistent food supply and a quality food supply is if we make the choice and the decision to do this ourselves. It was, after all, our calling from the very beginning of time. If any of you would like to inquire more about the training programs that we have, please look at my website. There's contact information for me on the website, both my email address, our phone number is there. You're going to have to look for it a little bit on the page where you can reserve a space in our training program is where my phone number is listed. You can go to that page without actually reserving a place if you choose to. I don't tell everybody where it is because I don't like getting a lot of crank phone calls, and when you post your phone number on the internet, it's kind of a risky thing. So it's a little bit hard to find, but our phone number is there. In any case, I do have links that are easy to find for my email there, and I'd be happy to try to encourage or help any of you in any way that I can. And for those of you that are here that are pastors or church leaders and you want to try to find a source of more information to share with your church members and maybe do some community outreach, I'd be happy to talk with you too about ways that we might be able to cooperate and using evangelism as part of your evangelism. Yes? I'm sorry? The plant population is very closely calculated, yes. That's correct. I cultivate most of my beds once, maybe twice. And for crops like tomatoes or cucumbers or things where the plants are spaced wide apart, I use hay mulch to do my weeding. I'm lazy. I want to do things the easiest way possible. By using transplants, the plants are growing vigorously when I put them in the ground. So number one, they've got a tremendous head start on the weeds. And number two, as the weeds do start to germinate, I can cultivate them lightly, and then shortly after that, the plant canopy will fill up so that I don't have serious weed problems, no. Yes? Could you speak up, please? I don't think we have a microphone here.
drill wide, I go back to 5 foot wide.
Mine are 5 feet wide.
Okay, how do you get in there and pick stuff without stomping them all down?
I reach, I'm able to reach 30 inches from each side, so I work half the row from one side and half the row from the other side. Now for me, 5 feet works. For some people, it won't. You may need to go to a narrower row, 40 or 42 inches for some people, but that's just predicated on what works for me.
When you have 5 foot rows, how many rows do you have in there?
It depends on what I'm planting. Anywhere from 3 to 5, but it depends on what I'm planting, and not only what I'm planting, but the time of year that I'm planting it. Broccoli, for example, that I grow in the spring, I space it about 14 inches. When I grow it in the fall, I space it at 18 inches because I get larger plants in the fall. So it depends on the time of year to some degree, too. But the objective is, as he pointed out, is to have the full utility of the soil. I don't want my plants so close together that they're competing with each other. I want to give them as much space as they need, but I don't want to give them any extra space because weeds are going to occupy that. Yes?
What is the difference between an heirloom seed and an open pollinated seed?
Nothing. They are nothing but marketing terms. An heirloom seed is simply a marketing term. In some instances, heirloom or heritage implies a variety that has been around for 25 years or more, but the reality is that they both mean exactly the same thing. Heirloom, open pollinated, heritage seed, those are all synonyms for a seed that will reproduce after its kind. Yes, again in the back. The ones that you saw in the greenhouses are about 4 to 5 inches, and the ones outside are between 6 and 8. And they're going to continue to get a little bit higher as I build organic matter in them. Yes. Good question. One of the problems in growing in a greenhouse is that we have a problem sometimes with humidity that is very, very high. The water evaporates, it accumulates on the plastic, it comes right back down on the ground again. So water management in the greenhouse is an important thing, particularly in order to avoid fungal diseases. I use a combination of different things in the greenhouse. I use overhead sprinklers for getting seedlings established in the greenhouse. Things like spinach, for example, I don't transplant. I actually seed that right into the ground. And I'll use sprinklers until the spinach is up a ways. I've got a line that goes down the center of the greenhouse and a little sprinkler head. It's a micro sprinkler that will sprinkle the beds. I water by hand in the greenhouses sometimes, and I also use drip tape in the greenhouses sometimes. Right now, I've got bell peppers in one of my greenhouses, and I irrigate those with drip tape. So I use a combination of systems. Yes? We did talk about that yesterday. First and foremost, what do? Pray. Pray is our first line of defense, okay? And our second line of defense is to have healthy plants so that we can resist pests to some degree. It does not make them immune, but it will resist them. And then apart from that, I have a number of different attack techniques that I use for pests. But I don't have time to cover that again today. I'm sorry. Yes, brother?
What about the 7-year rest period?
7-year rest period. Thank you for asking me that. I actually requested that he ask me that question. He asked it earlier, and I said, wait until this afternoon and ask me that. We were talking about legume cover crops, remember, when we were discussing our soil preparation? One of the most interesting crops that the Lord has given us is one that we don't eat. We feed it to a lot of the creatures that we raise, but we don't eat it ourselves, and it's really a shame because it's one of the most nutritious plants on the planet, and that's alfalfa. Alfalfa has an extremely deep root system. And it has the capacity to extend that root system 20 or 30 feet deep into the soil. And one of the schemes that I will share with you if you happen to come through our training program is how to use alfalfa as the basis for nourishing your soil once you get your initial chemistry balanced in your soil. If I have an acre of garden and I plant an acre of alfalfa, I can use that alfalfa to feed my garden. Alfalfa is a perennial plant. It will provide that food for my garden for 5 or 6 years easily. So what you can do to rest the land is to take your alfalfa in its sixth year and swap places so that you leave your original garden fallow for that seventh year of rest and you plant your crops where the alfalfa was growing. Now, you don't need additional alfalfa to nourish that crop that year because you've got the benefit of the entire root system of the alfalfa plant that was there. It's a very sound and practical way if you want to employ that concept of a Sabbath rest for your land every 7 years that will work and can work effectively. All right, I'll take maybe one or two more questions and then we'll wrap it up. He asked the question, what do you do about the seven-year rest for the land?
Yeah, just with all of the questions.
Yes. All right, any others? I think we're finished. We're about out of time. I want to thank you very much for your attention this week. It's been phenomenal to have a group this size after lunch every day all week. I really thank you for your interest. And I want to thank all of those that have participated in making this meeting such an incredible week. One more comment here, question.
Do you have any books that you'd recommend?
Do I have books that I recommend? I have a book that I have put together that is basically a compilation of things that I distribute in my class. It won't be very meaningful to you without that. But frankly, as I mentioned a few days ago, the paradigm that we're working with, growing nutritious food, in concert with biblical principles is not something that other folks know about. And the reality is that there is a lot of information out there right now. Gardening is very popular. A lot of people are producing books, but none of it really has the biblical foundation that we need. So the short answer to your question is no. Are there books out there that can be instructive? Yes. And there are books out there that have some very good information in them, but I'm reluctant to recommend them because there's also some erroneous information in many of these books. And unfortunately, Satan has taken this opportunity of an awareness in agriculture and people's desire to return to the soil and return to the understanding of the soil that we were to have from the very beginning. And there is tremendous spiritualistic influence in agriculture today, too, that you need to be aware of and wary of, frankly. So for those reasons and some others, I do not have any one single reference that I can send you to that will be of much help. One last question, and then we're going to pray.
I know what you said, once you plant one crop, you immediately turn the soil over and plant another crop.
I sometimes don't even turn the soil over. It depends on what I'm planting. It depends on what I'm planting. But sometimes no. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Oftentimes I will do it the same day. If I need to turn the soil over or add a little organic matter, I'll do that, but I'll replant the same area the same day. Yes. Okay. Well, thank you again for your attentions this week. It's been a blessing to be here, and I pray that you'll have a wonderful experience through the weekend here too. That's, please. Let's pray, shall we? Heavenly Father, thank you so much for the opportunity to come here and share with my brothers and sisters some of the experience that you've given to me. And I pray, Father, that as we've come to look at some very complex concepts this week, that the enemy has not stood in the way of encouraging us, that we can have good results in our desire to do what you would like us to do, and that is to attend seriously to our gardens and to be attentive to your creative energies and force that are around us. Father, I know, and I pray that others here will learn the powerful object lessons for us that you have within the garden, the wisdom that it teaches of you, the love that you demonstrate to us through the garden. I pray that those in attendance here too may have that blessing and that experience. And I ask that you dismiss us now with your grace. In Jesus' name I pray.